quite simple, really. Great stories with a good cup of tea. It's the Tea with Mike show. On this episode of the show, Ed Genevieve stops by. At topics of conversation included at theater and spoken word at poetry. So grab a cup of tea, sit back, and enjoy. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of the Tea with Mike show. Really excited for this one. Joining me from England is Genevieve. Welcome to Tea with Mike.
Thanks so much for having me.
And as we were saying just a few moments ago, it's always nice to talk to someone else that grew up in England. So I'm really excited to chat over a stereotype of the British, a good cup of tea. So, but we'll get to that a little later on. So do you want to start by telling everyone where you grew up?
Absolutely. So I'm one of those people who sort of travelled a little bit of the map of the UK, really. I was first born in Plymouth, right in the corner. And then we moved around a fair bit. And I actually ended up in a place called Basingstoke and a little town called Tadley, which I kind of think of always as Jane Austen sort of area. But actually, I'd be lying a little bit. It's tiny bit further up. Winchester would be sort of Jane Austen country, but it was a lovely area full of sort of green grasses and small communities, seven churches and one horse, and that's really the kind of sort of town I grew up in, one that was very community focused. Go for it, Mike.
No, carry on.
Over time, I'd also sort of travelled and spent a lot of time in London, especially when I was studying university. And now, as I think of myself as very much somebody still growing up, I'm now in sort of the Cambridgeshire area. So, as Mike would well know, a lot of travel as far as the southern part of the UK, really. But known for being a kid that's sort of moved from one place to another with sort of work my family had. But it's great because it feels very much English is the, and British is the culture, which I know very well.
Fantastic. And I know the Cambridge area fairly well because my grandparents actually live near Cambridge in a village called Orwell. So I spent a bit of time in like Cambridge and stuff. So obviously very expensive, but it's definitely a nice city for sure. Yeah. So obviously you just mentioned that you travel around a little bit. Do you think you prefer the big cities or do you like the quiet and typically nature of like small towns and villages?
I think when I was younger, especially growing up in quite a small town, I really liked the big cities. So going to London, going to Winchester, going to Newcastle. But actually, as I've got older, I think I've moved to really enjoying the smaller towns where the small communities. It's been really nice in this last year that the community I'm part of is very close-knit. And it's full of green grasses and lots of birds. So I think I've gravitated to small now recently, but that was a big change.
Fantastic. And probably with everything that's going on in the world, it probably feels like you can like shut it out a little bit and like really get aligned like into from a mental like health perspective and that type of thing.
Oh, absolutely. So just down the road from me is a sort of reserve area, and it's really lovely because social distancing happens because no one comes here. What's great in this particular part of Cambridgeshire. There's a lot of places that you can just sit and meditate as long as it's not raining on you too hard. otherwise, you might not want to. But yeah, there's lots of sort of quiet, and you're right, you can kind of not necessarily put it away. I think you have time to reflect on it a bit more. And I've some of my London friends who are still there at the minute, there's a different experience in that, but it's trying to find those places of peace and space really for anybody is always good.
Fantastic. And then go back a few years, like what were some of your kind of like favourite subjects in school?
Massive drama. I'm actually fighting the urge to use the jazz hands right now. It's really bad. Really loved drama. I loved that it was one of the classes that kind of made people integrate with each other a lot. So you didn't sit in the back of the room or in front of the room or wherever you sat and didn't engage with so many people. You were kind of, and my drama teachers, particularly in secondary school, moved us around quite a bit. So it gave us a great opportunity to meet lots of people. And I was quite shy as a kid. Probably still am in a way. But I loved that. I really loved English literature. It was my favourite thing to do, was quietly sit with a book and imagine. So reading out in class, combining that with drama, went really well. And even though I was awful at it, I quite like science. I think my teachers might have thought of me very differently in that manner, but I thought they were fascinating what they had to teach. And I had a really massive respect for my science teachers, actually, because they could do alchemy in a way that I never could. So yeah, so that's one of the favourites, definitely. But I quite liked studying at school, I must admit. I was always really grateful for everything to do with education. It's good times.
Fantastic. And so we definitely share some similarities. Like, two of my favorite subjects in school was drama, and also I guess I wouldn't necessarily say it was my favorite, but I was okay at it, and it was fascinating from a drama perspective. It was definitely like English literature, because when I was living in England, I used to live in close to Richmond, North Yorkshire. I went to I, so I went
Sorry.
so 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 I went to school in like Richmond, and I actually had the fantastic opportunity of performing at the Georgian Theatre Royal, which dates back to the, I think it's the 16th century, and it's well known for the pantomime.
Amazing. Did you ever get into any of the pantomimes as well when the
No,
opportunity was there?
I didn't, it used to be a family tradition. We'd go on like Boxing Day, like every year, and we'd sit in the like the Shakespeare box and watch it. I just loved it.
That sounds so awesome and such a wonderful family experience as well. Oh, I love it.
Yeah, no, for sure. So when I was doing my research, it said that you've been working in the theaters for like approximately 6 years, to writing and directing plays. So do you want to first talk to how you kind of got started in the theater world?
Sure. So when I was studying in school and then going on to college, drama definitely was the thing I was most comfortable with. And I found it as a great way of sort of exploring lots of different things. And eventually I decided that it would be quite fun to try that at university, which was amazing. So I went to Goldsmiths, and Goldsmiths is an amazing arts university in London, and part of the University of London group. And the experience of that sort of blew my mind, because when I'd done it in school, it was kind of like science only by sort of Einstein and Newton, and then suddenly you go and study at university and you've got this whole world you weren't aware of. And it's through that and getting those experiences that I wanted to be more and more involved with it. So I started sort of like specking up scripts. Midsummer Night Dream is one of my absolute favorite plays, and so I did a version of that. But I wanted to adapt. Got a few friends together to have a read of it. It went okay. And then we didn't put it on. And through sort of doing those bits and pieces, and staying kind of involved with that, I actually met my, I guess I'd call him my directing mentor, really, Paul Vitti. And he gave me my first opportunities in working with theatre. He trained me through assistant directing and also formally directing. And I got a chance to try lots of different pieces. We did Romeo and Juliet, we did Merchant of Venice. What I loved about working with the organisation, so Venture Wolf Productions, was they really wanted to take pieces that people have known a long time and reimagine them in so much that they would look at the aspect of it that may have been sort of forgotten about over time. So the one of the pieces I did was Romeo and Juliet, and I really wanted to have a look at the family aspect of that, and a theory that I had that every character, especially the younger characters, had an adult character who wasn't their direct parent, who would really be the one watching out for them. So Juliet, a nurse, Romeo has the friar. And it was almost one to one. It wasn't perfect, but I cheated. And with that exploring, I started to look at things like rock and roll, and particularly the change in the 1950s when we stopped rationing. And it hit upon this idea of like a very angry youth trying to look at what had happened with the war, and especially with the long time rivalry. And that all kind of built an idea, and that was something that Venture Wolf were very open to, was coming to them with ideas about, this is where I've got from the original script, this is where I'm coming from, this is how I want to develop, and getting the opportunity to try. Once I'd finished doing a couple of works with them, I sort of moved, And I then met some artists for a directing course, and we formed a theatre company together for Creativity. And we started making new writing, and that was the first time I'd staged one of my own plays, Prison. And that was really the most amazing experience. Trying to put it all together, trying to find funding, the incredible actors, and there were two different casts for it, because we did it twice. And the best experience of it is why I went full circle, because on the second time round, we went to the George Wood Theatre, which is the internal theatre for Goldsmiths, and it had just had a renovation, and we opened it for the students, and we did a performance for them, and we did a performance for our audiences in this brand new theatre space that was literally like smashing the wine bottle against the ship to start a whole new year. And that's been the experience of amazing people, just really amazing people who get behind you. And I love the collaborative nature of theatre. It is not impossible to do a one-man show, completely one man, but someone's got to light it, unless you want to do a lot of running.
Fantastic. So, I guess what is it that you enjoy about like theater the most? Do you get a rush from the adrenaline that makes you want to do it again, or as you just kind of alluded to, is it more some of the amazing people and the diversity and that side of things?
Oh, absolutely. When I first got into it, I did as most people want to do. I wanted to be an actor. And I do, if I ever do step on the boards and with the spoken word, I get this a little bit, that kind of initial feeling of, wow, that's a lot of human beings. That does have like an energy of its own. But as I got older and the more I sort of experienced stuff, there is something about being with artists who have vision that you don't. You might have sat there for like 3 or 4 hours working on a script, going through the lines, and there's like a whole schema one can work through. And you then take it to a rehearsal room or the first reading, and they read it in a completely different way to what you're expecting. Or the lighting designer says, oh yeah, we can totally do that with an orange. You're like, we can? Great, show me how. And that energy of people, when they have your idea in their hands, and I very much have this belief that at that point it's not mine anymore, it belongs to them. And watching them go with these concepts or find something, or even a little bit. So I used with Prison, I co-directed it with my best friend Tiziana, and she would look at the script and go, is that the word you were looking for? I was like, nope. Should we change it? Yes, let's do that, shall we? Or she'd find something funny, because she's a brilliant comedic actress. She'd find something really funny that I hadn't realised was funny, and she's like, "Well, that will change that scene," and that is incredible. You just look at people with awe. I've had actors, so I did eventually do Midsummer Night's Dream properly, and we did a very small version, just looking at the lovers and these four people in space working together, finding connections that I'd never seen people stage before. We were in a tiny little basement of a theatre, practicing, and underneath a bookshop. And you're sitting there going, this is as good as stuff I've seen in the Oscars. And you know that if that person can repeat it and you can just guide them in the right way, or particularly, they almost have it perfect some a couple of reads in. But as you're doing stuff and changing things, they forget things. And they might forget that they've done this line really, really well because you've given them a different direction that take them took them on a different direction. So you have to kind of keep like a symphony in your head, of every part you've agreed to or every note, so that you can keep the beat. And it does feel like when you see instructors going up a little bit, down a little bit, but with a line. And there's a whole language to guiding people to get the best out of them and get the best out of the production that is so intricate, it never stops fascinating me. So yeah, I guess that's the biggest draw, really.
Nice, and I would definitely agree. There's always a new perspective to look at the same script or a piece of work that you're developing. If you bring in a new people with different perspective, different experiences, like their look and insight on the same script is going to be like totally different. And that's the coolest part when you're like standing around and then you have that jaw-dropping moment, or you see it from a different angle, and you're like, it kind of gives you like goosebumps, and you're like, whoa, this is why I love the creative process like so much, right?
Absolutely. And then if it all goes right on the night, and even when it doesn't, because some of the best moments when things don't go right, it's just that wonderful fulfillment of everything you achieved. And I often sort of wonder, especially with doing this podcast, do you feel the same sometimes? You're like, ah, oh, everything edited together, ready to go. I remember those moments and that chat. I imagine it must feel exactly the same.
Yeah, no, there's definitely like parallels. So I'll be going about other things that I do in my life, or like I'll start talking to a guest that I've had on the show, maybe a week later, 2 months later. Then it's like, oh yes, we share that like powerful moment, that moment of like connection. And that's literally like my favorite thing about doing this is all the great all the people I'm connecting with all over the world and learning different things and that type of thing. And it doesn't get better.
Absolutely agree with you. Absolutely agree.
Cool, and so now we're just going to take a brief intermission, and we're going to have a little tea fact. So this is actually quite an appropriate tea fact, because we're both obviously from England, and it actually relates to London. This wasn't on purpose. This is just how it happened. So the London tea auction was an institution which lasted for 300 years. Tea was sold using the in quotations by the candle system. Tea was and bidding for lots basically went on until an inch of a candle had burnt away, and that was kind of like how they sold tea to like bidders. So the candle. So my understanding is the candle represented the amount of time, and then once the time had surpassed, then whoever I presume had the highest bid, like got the tea or so on and so forth.
That's really fascinating.
Oh, and this comes from fine dining at glovers.com. So yeah, that's another part of the show that's fascinating, learning like tea on the surface, like a lot of things seem so simple, but it's got its own history, its own like story like within it, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Awesome, and then we're just going to keep going along. So, what do you find the most challenging about when you're directing a play?
I think it's sometimes if I don't necessarily have a question when I first go in. So, I guess, yeah, I'll take the example of The Midsummer's Dream as a really good example of this. So, it got posed to me, could you do most of the play but only in an hour? I was like,
Oh,
oh,
wow.
there's a question. There's a question. And through that, it allowed me to look and realize that, though there's been a lot of characters that we focus on. So, for anyone who knows Midsummer's Dream well, the image they might have in their head is Titania as the fairy or Bottom as the donkey, etc. But really, there is one story for it, which is Hermia's. So, one of the lovely characters, in the sense that she runs away with her boyfriend into the woods. It goes very wrong with some love potion. Everything gets switched around. She comes out the other end, and she's one of the few Shakespearean heroines I can think of, which actually gets exactly what she wanted, which is rare. It goes all right for her. A bit dodgy in the middle. But that was a storyline. So that became the storyline. And then it was very easy to start sort of snipping scenes. I think I've had things sort of passed to me, so friends' works, and I really love it when somebody brings me something they want me to review and study or a film script they're working on. But if I can't sort of form a question, I usually think, is this one for me? Because if one doesn't have a question they want to answer through the process, it becomes difficult to guide through. And one of the things I genuinely love about actors is they ask lots of questions. They will come at you from every direction. And it truly is an honor to the script of the playwright or the director or the producer, whoever sort of came up with the initial idea. If they want to ask that deeply, you've done something right. Because they will want to know as much as possible about their character, the world, and you do need to understand and world build that for them. So if you aren't asking those questions yourself because you don't really know or you've not got that interest, it might not be quite the right project. And I have had scripts where I've gone, no, but I know who this would be perfect for.
Oh,
As
nice.
you know, 'cause, yeah, oh, that's definitely happened where I've gone, that's not a me, that's a so-and-so. Because usually, the person, if they've come into you, sort of particularly handing it, they feel it's pretty ready, or at least give them the feedback to say, not yet, but I would do this. So, yeah, that can be funding. It is one of the only projects types in the world where you may not have everything you need beforehand, and you pay for everything before you see anything. It can be difficult to balance everything, how much time, and it is also that time cost. You don't want to waste rehearsal time for actors. You don't want to pull in your designers at the wrong moments and waste their time. But equally, you want to make sure they're much part of the process if you're a collaborative kind of director. It's a lot of balancing, but for the right kind of person and the right kind of people, it can be their joy to be, really. And challenge is good for people.
That's fantastic. And so would you say this is the process, and as you alluded to, like the decision-making process, knowing when to pull in members of the creative team, both from a budgeting and a funding perspective too. Would you say that's something that you've got better at as you've developed more experience?
I think so. It's something that's become fascinating, like learning how to bid for people as well. So you want to come at your design team and your technical team pretty much, this is how much I'm paying, this is hours, this is what I need you to have, and this is when I need you. Actors, you might need to work around some other scheduling plans if you only be able to rehearse at the weekend. Great, they might be able to do their day job, or they might be able to do their film. You can only learn that with experience. There is a wonderful book by Katie Mitchell, which is all about directing. It's literally the first and only, really, handbook on directing. And she goes into quite a lot of depth about that. But even then, knowing how to work people together when everybody has to work day to day, and unless you are very clear about your structure as far as paying week by week by week, people, it can be a lot of negotiation. But in that negotiation, you find that your artists, and that's how I like to refer to them, I guess, have a lot of the answers in themselves. They know, and if you're happy to share the process with them, like, this is where we are, this is what we need, how would you like to do this, this is how this would be funded, the relationship is better. Nobody likes thousands of emails, so I learned to very well to cut that down. Oh, you didn't get that email. I can understand why. They just want to know clear answers. And some classic sort of project management tools about how you set a timeline work quite well for theatre. So that's something that I developed as well. I went to study project management for a little while, and it does help. So as long as keep trying, you're as honest with people as possible, and you just think about where your resources are and all the different streams of it going on at one time, you'll pull off a good show. And if you have worked that hard with people and are honest with yourself and your vision and your mission, it does generally work right on the night. But you're right, yeah, it's been a long run of experience with people and sort of many a mistake along the way.
Fantastic. And now, do you want to dive and talk to us a little bit about being the co-owner of Fork Creative and GT Theatrix? Can you tell us kind of a little bit about those organizations, kind of your role, and kind of the mission and the vision behind those companies?
Absolutely. So G&T Theatrix was the first one that sort of created, and that was with Tiziana. What that was really about was teaching theatre tricks to people and theatre skills. And our focus really was being young people, how the training, and Tiziana has so many different experiences because she's from Italy originally.
Cool.
So she did Conti, and yeah, it's a fascinating experience. So she's got about 20 years experience on top of mine. How improvisation skills are so valuable when you're in the middle of a meeting, how to engage people, how to read into scripts and find information that's all really there from somebody and utilize that, which is really helpful for them when they're studying for their exams. What materials, what is valuable. So that's how we utilise that. And the idea was, it was mostly improvisation over about 3 or 4 days, where they would study all these different experiences, and at the end they do a performance for their family. And we had great experience of testing that out with different actors. And particularly what has been valuable with it is learning that it's also just as useful engaging people in the Zoom world that we're living in, really, to utilise that when they're presenting and communicating with people. And then 4KTV was built out of a desire to create spaces for the four artists who all had come from non-traditional backgrounds to British theatre. And we were all writers. We all had an idea, or they were all writers. I was the latest in the, I was the baby of the family. I didn't know how to write a play, so I learned from them. And the intention with 4KTV really was to tell different stories. Especially by people that people hadn't heard of. And we had the intention and a mission to create art that was community focused. So every play had to have something to do with a wider social issue. So we had plays about environmentalism. We had my work, which was about PTSD. We had another artist which looked at growing up Black and minority ethnic, and another one who looked at what the experiences of engaging with people who have a very different perspective on race to them. And each of us would switch around. So I was director and playwright for the first piece. The next time round, the director, who was my producer, I became his producer. And so everyone got a chance at everything. None of us particularly wanted to act, but opportunity to be there. Yeah, funny enough, we're all kind of like avoided that quite a bit, because I don't think any of us felt like we were the best actors, but we were much better at directing actors. And we all took a part in somebody else's work. As on an organisational side for both companies, I was key administrator and sort of head of communications, really. I enjoy emailing, contacting people, having chats and stuff like this, and making things happen. I'm also the one who tends to be good with paperwork, surprisingly, which my English and science and everything teacher would be very surprised to hear, become something I've got better at in time. So dealing with contracts, scheduling, sorting out the play scripts, making sure everyone's got the second email with the play scripts, became kind of my main job, but also meant I got to take care of box office, which is always good, and be the main communicator to customers as well, so people purchasing us into the show if they had any requirements. So the second run when we had Goldsmiths, we had a lady who had different needs, and we had to sort of support making sure the university actually supported her, and they were brilliant at it, may I add. That was kind of my core thing, because bringing people together through stringent paperwork and communications and bringing their art together is the stuff that I like the most. The gentleman who was my producer is just the kind of guy who walks into a space and everyone wants to talk to him. So he was perfect at being our connection manager, and he would be the one who'd go and sort of talk to everyone about the show. And Tiziana was absolutely brilliant at kind of bringing us to heel. So she became the CEO. And that's how we kind of judged it based on our characters. But yeah, that's kind of the core about each company. And I'm so honoured to have learnt with them. I really am.
Fantastic. And it sounds like everyone quickly realised that everybody has different strengths, and that's a good thing, because you needed someone to fill many different roles, and often on limited funding you have to fulfill multiple roles, right?
Absolutely right, absolutely. And it's no better way to learn, because I think if you're going to then subcontract it later, you need to know at least a little bit about it. So it gave us a chance to learn and support and then guide other people who were helping us. We took a younger member on, and he had an excellent ability with technical. So we said, right, you're a technical manager, you're going to be the one to speak to the lighting designers at the university, you're going to be the one to train the people we're supporting, you're going to do the recording, you'll manage all that, which let him step up. And it was also something that the three of us weren't particularly comfortable with, and we didn't know. We'd had a previous young lady who was really, really, really great at talking on a publication side. And I think if you don't, even in the theatre world where you think things may be more standardised, if you don't utilise the talent that's there, both on a managerial side and an artistic side, you don't really get the most of the experience. And even way back when I was doing Amdram, with back in Tadley, that's something I noticed with the Amdrams. So that was Tadley Youth Drama. they all took a place in running it and being the mentors to us as the children. But they also all delineated their skill set really well because they were teachers and doctors and church leaders who basically were volunteering to do this. So even though I probably didn't think about it at the time of creating both these companies, that taught me a lot about how you manage people on particularly limited budgets.
Fantastic. And then so it's my understanding that you've taken all of this experience and you've dived a little bit into the coaching side. So do you want to talk about how you utilize the skills both in directing and writing and producing and all of the other things that it sounds like you've done along the way, from the box office to communication? How do you take all of those experiences and molded into being a coach?
So it's basically turning somebody with their own life, so particularly it's job coaching that I do, into the star of their own lives and reminding them why they do what they do. Often I'm looking for that kind of hidden mission statement or that hidden script. And I've actually, oh gosh, I've actually written a poem about that. I'm sorry, just hit me in a second. But yeah, fundamentally, what I do with the coaching is the same I would do as I would with an actor or trying to coach a newer technical artist. It is looking at where their skill sets currently are, what they understand about their script, which really is their CV, and then starting to train them to be able to evaluate it effectively. So look at those kind of hidden themes. Well, you say that you've been this kind of administrator for a very long time, but actually you've always had the purse strings. Are you sure finance doesn't fit you? Can you argue it through experience rather than that particular qualification? You don't think you're much of a public speaker, but I have noticed from this and experiences where you've been pushed, maybe pushed more than offered, presentation experience, and you stepped up. Are you really sure you can't? And often people have a lot more skill sets than they think they do, but we're taught very much to sort of place our script, our scripts, there we go, I suppose our CVs in an order that feels historical rather than experiential. And really, particularly the term CV rather than resume, it means course of my life or course of life. So it's really valuable when coaching people to say, this is the course of your life, even if it twisted and turned and you ended up in a city you never expected, you did those things, you existed in that experience, you had those choices. Now you just need to represent them. And often once I've got them to that particular point, then I start mentoring them on, right, you know the script and you know how to present it to me, which is great, but I'm not going to interview you because I haven't got a job to offer you. Now let's get that to that next level. And what the big part of the mentorship is really, okay, now it's time to perform and let's get them to start using their jazz hands. But all from that experience of tell a story. Tell the people who are interviewing you about your skills, because a lot of information out there is wonderful about that, but doesn't necessarily go from that sense of these are my traits, this is who I believe I am, to this is what I can do. And almost everyone I can think of, even from people particularly you've interviewed, they have found a way to either mentor themselves or have that mentor in their life. And I found the more I did coaching through acting, coaching through lots of different artistic forms, the more I realised I really enjoyed that. So it's a lovely little add-on to my experience. And every new person is like seeing a new play in a weird way, especially when they finally nailed it and it's like, dang it, she got it. And come back to me saying, I got the interview. I'm like, yes, I knew you could. It's very heartwarming. And particularly my experience of that in the same time as doing the theatre work has been working with young people in it, particularly at that kind of cusp of shiny eyes.
Fantastic, and I'm sure some of the people that you work with can relate to you, because you're also a demonstration of how you've constantly been pivoting and taking on multiple different roles and taking risks at time and stretching yourselves from. Because it would have been easy to be like, I just want to write plays, but you've also you understand about contracts and a little bit about finance and the box office, and even though it's not your favorite thing in the world, you. Is man, that you've also acted, and you've always I guess been evolving.
Thank you. I think that's the best way to be. I mean, all the kind of artists and philosophers and people that I love from history that seems to be a rhythm that they go down, which is just, you know, experience it all while you're here and make sure that you pay it forward in some format. And always in artistic form, in coaching, in anything that I try and do, even just trying to be a good daughter and sister, I try and do that because one time, one life is kind of how I view things. But it makes it so much nicer as well when you sit back and you go, oh, yeah, when did that come from? Well, I guess I know because I've said it to somebody. And I hope going forward it stays the same. But it does make everything very exciting.
Fantastic. And are you still helping people during the pandemic on that side?
Absolutely. At moments when I felt like I was going stir crazy, I lent on a few of my friends who are very much part of the artistic gig community. Just saying, hey, can I help out? Because I needed to do something. And writing was a massive part of that, performance part, a massive part of that, but I still need something else. And right. It was a good grounding experience, really, to do so. So, yeah, there's a couple of friends that I'm particularly working with now and a client as well.
Fantastic. And it's always good to stay busy, just in general, especially with all of the turbulence that's going on in the world right now, right?
Absolutely, yeah, I agree.
Fantastic. And let's switch gears a little bit, and then let's talk a little bit about spoken word poetry. So let's start off kind of with how you got started in spoken word poetry.
It really is one of those things that kind of happened by accident. So I had meandered a lot with working on a poetry book, and it was one of those things I'd pick up and put down, I'd pick up and put down, and it even started to be up again, then moving to CAMS and then put it back down again. And then obviously COVID-19 hit. And particularly I started sharing my work more when the situation with George Floyd happened. And I see lots of conversations and I was like, well, in theory, I have a perspective here. Why not include it? And particularly because I was part of lots of little groups that were discussing it a lot. And the situation of Black Lives Matter, but they weren't necessarily talking to the many different people of colour in the group about it. It was more kind of like just very esoteric discussions. And I thought, well, this is a chance to share some of the things I've been writing, if only just to respond, because if I write this in a blog post, it's going to sound like a rant. So okay. I shared it more as a poem instead, and that actually got great engagement. In doing that and starting to share on social media and starting to build up my page through Genevieve Frey Poet, people said, oh, have you ever considered performing this live? And I thought, well, that's back to the acting again. Oh, sure. Panic set in. And then as it happened, there was a group, some virtual poetry readings that were doing weekly readings for a few hours on a Saturday. And they were in a group that I was part of called Poetry UK. And they put up an advert saying, hey, we're doing this. These are the different, and it was that bigger thing that these are all the different time zones. You know, if you're interested, please get in contact. Got in contact with them. Adrian, who I spoke to, said, yeah, by all means, this is the information. And I remember that very first session. I did it downstairs. I've learned a lot since then about spacing. And the kindness, the friendly nature, the feedback, the general way that people were so amazing. I hadn't quite experienced it before, because it was like if you'd done a full stage performance but immediately the audience respond rather than necessarily a few claps later. They gave advice, they gave guidance, and I came again and again and again, and then started getting involved in lots of other different sessions, and I gained a love for it. And I'd never seen my work as being something that could be performed. But what I gained from it was a much better reading, suddenly going, oh, that comma means something. Oh, that's actually a full stop. It's nothing like reading it out loud to see what your grammar mistakes are. But also a chance to see the stories told differently and find a different voice. And it's really made me believe that there is a power in telling your story. And thanks to it, I have made some of the most incredible friends. Useful, wonderful people from across the world, including Davino, who you've spoken
yes.
to before.
And this is sort of how we connected. It. Small world, isn't it?
It is. I mean, the man's a legend, a living legend. But yeah, he came into like the third or fourth session, and he arrived as a full energy, including Candy, who works closely with him, and is his partner in Mia Love and Spoken House, and just both of them, they arrived, and you're just like, wow. Who is this wonderful energy here? Who are these people? I want to know these people. And those communities, the Instagram poet community, all of those people have such a sense of community, such a power in engaging with each other. I hadn't felt that way since theatre, with that same sort of collaborative nature. But instead of multiple people working on one play, it's singular people or engaging with their own small plays, and performing in so many different styles. So I have fallen in love with it, but it's only like in 2 months will be my anniversary of spoken word, shall we say. So it's all very new, but it's really changed my life.
Fantastic. And in maybe a couple of sentences, if someone, how would you define spoken word poetry for somebody that knows nothing about it?
It is a poetic form that is all about a level of lyricism, and knowledge of beat. And there is a nature of representing yourself and your poem that you don't always necessarily get on the page, because you become as the full package. You and your work integrate into each other, and it is a way of expressing yourself through lyrics and beats and notes and things, that expresses the deepest part of a person's heart. And you may never see the written version of that poem, but you'll feel it as soon as you hear
That's very good.
it.
I know when I was working at the Edmonton Fringe, big second largest fringe festival in the world after Edinburgh. I came across some people because they were in the same venue performing spoken word poetry, and I'm like, I didn't even know what spoken word poetry was, and but I went to a few performances just because I happened to have time on my hands. Like the first few times, I didn't really understand it. It felt weird, but then as you start to listen more closely and you hear the same performance a second or a third time, it's like, wow, this is powerful. I'm like feeling this, and it's that amazing invisible connection, even though you know nothing about the person at that moment in time, right?
Absolutely. I'm going to use the universal spoken word reaction to that, which is this, and say absolutely.
So awesome. So you mentioned that you started getting involved in these different poetry sessions, and you've been developing more experience, and there's definitely a connection there with the performance, and I think that's what you like about it, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's that feeling of being able to present and perform in a way that I've just never had before, and it does make me feel a lot more confident than the acting does, because you can kind of vibe with your audience, and engage them in a slightly different way, because you feel for how they're reacting, and you definitely can do that with a monologue, but it is that sort of sense of being there and presenting oneself that I love.
Nice. And then obviously, with it being the pandemic, you're having to perform virtually. So do you want to talk as like briefly about some of the opportunities and the challenges of performing through a technology a piece in terms of trying to get across the character and the representation and the emotions?
There's been so yeah, there really has been a sort of strengths and opportunities situation, and weaknesses as well. I mean, you can't vibe in quite the same way unless you set yourself on grid screen, and even then, if one can lose a track if they're trying to look at everyone's eyes. Where I guess when you're sort of slightly elevated on stage, and then sort of head to knee sort of level with your audience, it's a slightly different thing. But there is some power to it as well if you use the visual form. There's been pieces that I have that I'll direct a line to a person here, and then direct it in the same old skills that you would do when doing a monologue anyway. It's like, I want to say this to this particularly pretty lady, and I want to say this particularly pretty gentleman, and no, I don't like you. Which you can play with comedic scripts anyway, or even dramatic ones, shall I say. But really, the tricks with it is to see that person's screen almost as your opposite television screen. and to think of them as like, whereabout is their eye line towards yours, and how can I make that little moment where they laugh and smile and share, and utilize how far or close you can be with your camera. So it's a different form in that way, but what I particularly like about it as well is the same respect and patience you'd have if you were in a small bookshop performing your piece, or in a large theatre space performing your piece, or on the side of the road reading it as a busking style, is kind of there. It's probably a little less heckling, maybe because most people put themselves on mute. Fundamentally, it has a lot of similarities as well. It's just allowing for time changes and did that line get lost because of the Wi-Fi that you might not have had to consider. But you can play a lot, and the experience of performing for friends' book launches and bits and pieces like that is, if you time it right to the audience that you have in front of you, especially if you know anything about them, you can just get the same sort of experience, and you can still feel the same warmth as if you were in that room with people. I look forward to the day when we can be face to face again as people, but until then, it's not as different as people would think once you get into it.
Fantastic. And that's sort of the last point that I kind of want to ask you about before we get into your performance, which I'm really excited, and I'll give you the full stage to introduce it and everything in a minute. But what is the most important thing that you have learned so far in your like overall career, and what piece of kind of advice would you pass on to aspiring poets, playwrights, I guess any of the roles that you've kind of fulfilled so far in your creative journey?
So I think the greatest learning has been to just do it and be present, allow for the mistakes, the light not right on the nights, and everything that you'll learn in between. And to learn, and the more I've learned, more professionalism as an artist, and there is a whole sort of scheme of professionalism as an artist, the more I've got out of it, but the more I network through learning from professional artists, the better I've got. And that then leads to the second question, which is, what, when it comes to becoming an artist and being a successful artist, really take the opportunities that are available to you, but choose them carefully. If you know that you are not the one for that particular arts contract, don't go for it, but definitely investigate into it before you say no. Not to be intimidated by the differences in people's art, but use it as an opportunity to learn things that you don't know how to do. So if that person is so much better directing people, or so much better at finding that little line that you go, oh, that's amazing, look at how they do it, learn as much as possible, engage them, talk to them, because people are very open about their art, and they're definitely eager to tell you if you come to them with the right kind of open questions. And even if one wanted to do something completely different, so you are now going to be a biochemist, the same skills are true. Learn as much as possible, research as much as possible, and get involved where you can in what you want to do, because 9 out of 10 times, after a bit of experience, you'll become the one that other people come to anyway for your expertise, and you won't even realise you arrived at it.
Fantastic. And so now we've come to the time where the spotlight is truly on you, and I'm really excited and blessed that you're going to perform some spoken word poetry for the audience today.
Thank you so much. And I'm, funny enough, going to fiddle the spotlight just for a second. So the piece I'm going to do, I wrote about 2 years ago. It's called Glass Bottom Moon. And it's kind of a fable that tells you a story about getting to a stronger part of mental health. And if you're happy for me to go, we'll get ready to go.
Take it away.
Fantastic. Glass Bottom Moon. He rested his head in a pint glass. Stephen walked. Seamus laughed. Julie could only sigh, her downward eyes refusing to cry. But she'd never breathe a word, her doubt reciting in his mind. A father provides, a husband knows, a man withstands, but he just falls, sweeping his hopes to an unforgiving floor, watching them tumble, the shards explode. Ow! Roars the owner. So he's off alone. The night clear of protection, the river was silent, the river looked like home for the lost merman, a sailor desiring to drown. And the siren called him, Queen Mirror of the Downtrodden. He almost stepped towards her when he saw Lady Moon, her brilliant luminescence reflecting within Queen Mirror's hair. His advance halted by a glare. He falters, her wave song slowly pulling until he realized where she led. Confused, he backs away running. Moonlight reveals the path ahead of him. Out of breath, he finds a clearing. Lady Moon is the size of the sky. He kneels before her, his muddy trousers sucker holding him safely to the ground. What hope is there? She listens, gives not whisper. Finally facing his pain, your man begins to howl. Wolf of instinct he is now, suffocated into growl, drinking to keep it down, and finally succumbs to silence. Slowly he rises, mud covered, wet, but more human than before, making it back to shore Odysseus travels. His sweet Penelope gently snores. He washes his feet and footprints off her freshly cleaned floor. He passes his baby's room on the way to his lady's bed. Standing at the window, Lady Moon gently leant. Speak, write and belong, is all she ever said. He nods and kisses his son, his heart clear of dread.
Fantastic. So good. Thank you for performing.
Thank you ever so much.
I definitely felt the energy and the connection of the different characters versus the narration part, even from the technology and from the distance that we are apart.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much.
And thank you also for being on the Tea with Mike show today.
It's been such a pleasure, and thank you for sharing with me today.
No problem, guys. And that was another episode of the Tea with Mike show. It's the Tea with Mike show.